Well, there were a group of people that came together and looked at the gun issue. And
two weeks after the deadly theater shooting incident, survivors in Aurora are still dealing with the aftermath in their own lives. Others are in the process of analyzing how such an event could happen and whether it can be prevented in the future. Initial reactions were reflexive, relying on past belief and understanding. To honor the victims and survivors, we believe it's time to be open-minded and reflective instead. In that spirit, we want to begin a conversation on what, if anything, should be done and how. It's clear that political division marks any discussion of policy on gun control and mental health in our society. It's also hard to ignore comparisons to other countries and see that the U.S. has a far greater rate of deaths from gun violence than the 22 other so-called rich nations of the world, more than three times higher than the U.K., Australia, or Canada, our closest cultural comparisons. In the most recent year of full data, 2009, more than 31,000 people died in this country due to firearms injury. That's about equal to the number of traffic fatalities every year in the U.S. Tonight, we'll talk about it with a group of former lawmakers from Colorado. I'm Doug Price, and this is Colorado Quarterly for August 2012. Good evening. Tonight we welcome former Colorado Governor Bill Ritter, former Republican Senate Minority Leader Josh Pinnery, and former Democratic Speaker of the House Andrew Romanoff. Josh, let's start with you. What's your response to the political leadership's activities since the shooting in Aurora?
You know, I at the outset, I think Governor Hickenlooper has handled himself very well. As you noted in your introductory comments, I think a lot of people sort of went to their entrenched positions and tried to leverage the situation to suit their political arguments. And I think in stepping back from it and just articulating the scope and breadth of the tragedy and in cautioning against overtly politicizing many of these choices and discussions, I think he did a great service to himself, but also to the dialogue around it. So I think his steady hand certainly played out. And I think most people, when they see, you know, the politicians hop up on TV and advocate for this or against that, they sort of recoil. The sentiment is that this is a terrible tragedy, a terrible situation. And once the grieving ends, then those policy conversations can commence.
There does come a time to act and to think about what you want to do to respond to the constituents on both sides of any particular argument. Governor Ritter, as the Denver DA, you had the largest policy role in responding to Columbine. Can you walk us through sort of what happened then and the things that you thought were positive and negative about that that time?
Well, there were a group of people that came together and looked at the gun issue, and a variety of things were done. One was done by the voters of the state. I think it was Amendment 22, pretty overwhelming response by the voters when they closed what was called the gun show loophole. There were some other things done legislatively. Straw purchasing was made illegal. So there were a variety of things, but other things that had to do with schools and with, just protecting schools, trying to figure out how to, what we call, harden the target, and also inside schools to really look at bullying. There were programs that were, out of the Attorney General's office, out of Ken Salazar's office, but supported by Governor Owens, that were about schools that weren't legislative, but were really about building up programs that sort of address a variety of issues that didn't have anything to do with guns, quite frankly.
Tom Mauser, who was a parent of a Columbine victim, talked about the leadership of Bill Owens and Ken Salazar together. Are there lessons to be learned there?
First of all, it was bipartisan, so that was healthy. I think in these kinds of things, it's important that we don't gravitate to the one thing. And I think we did a pretty good job of that after Columbine. People believing, well, this is about gun control or the lack of, good gun regulation. Other people saying this is only about mental health and about red flags, or this is about police response or EMT response. In fact, it's about all of those things or a combination of those, and it may be, a lot more of one thing than it is of another. But policy conversations that are about just one thing often miss the point, particularly if we're addressing an incident that's happened and trying to really, in a sense, say it's this thing we need to address. You can miss a lot of other really important things. This Aurora shooting is no different than that. There will be a lot of lessons learned. It's important for people to think about this as broadly as possible and say, what are all the things that is part of being, you know, an American society? What are the things that we can glean from this and that we can do to address this in hopes of preventing another one, but if not preventing another one, making it more difficult? And again, it's important for policymakers to do it in a bipartisan fashion and to say it's not a single thing.
Well, in the preamble to the show today, we talk a little bit about the prevalence of gun violence in the United States. You're 22 times more likely to occur than in the comparable countries that are nearest to us. But in these incidents, there always seems to be a confluence of both the gun law and mental health. You've recently, Andrew, been the Speaker of the House. Give us a sense of, I mean, in a time not of crisis, but in a general sort of electoral cycle, what pressures you were feeling with respect to mental health, what pressures you were feeling with respect to gun control.
Well, if you're suffering from mental illness and you can't get treatment or a loved one is, it is a time of crisis. It's always a time of crisis in that sense. My take is Colorado has not done a particularly good job of making it possible for people who suffer from mental illness to get the care they need. Outside of this incident, the truth is we ought to be doing everything we possibly can to make sure that folks who suffer from brain disease get the care they need to avoid hurting themselves or other people. I think the responsibility, as Governor Ritter was suggesting, as a policymaker at a time of a crisis or not, is to evaluate the concerns of your constituents. And when I was in the legislature, Josh and I spent a long time working on these issues, to ask advocates a couple questions. Tell us, what's the evidence of a problem? And pretty clearly no shortage of those in this state or any other. And then tell us why a change in state law, if that's what you're proposing, is the best solution, as opposed perhaps to better enforcement of existing laws, a change in local or federal law, or for that matter, action in the private sector outside the sphere of law.
Josh, well, it might not be fair. I think given the fact that you represent Republican leadership, there's an expectation of the public as to what your viewpoint might be on guns and gun control. As a legislator, in some ways the minority leader gets to play offense more than they play defense. Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense of a desire to have things happen in that arena, or was it relatively quiet?
Well, there were during my time of service, the Columbine debates about gun control had sort of had come and gone, and the laws were on the books. There was less discussion about it. But I think generally now, and you see it here, the public is highly skeptical of this notion that with a stroke of the pen or enactment of a new law or a new statute that government, that the state legislature or the federal, the United States Congress can come in and solve these situations. I think Governor Ritter is exactly right. These are complex circumstances with complicated fact patterns that give rise to a host of situations. And again, to go back to something that Governor Hickenlooper said in the immediate aftermath, we also have to acknowledge that sometimes in free and open societies consisting of 300 million people, that horrible, unacceptable, tragic, but isolated situations happen. And we have to be slow to sort of swing the whipsaw of government action too quickly in recognition of the fact that in many instances these are isolated situations that free societies have a hard time accounting for.
Well, having said that, I do think, while you have to view it broadly, we had a variety. I was part of the debates around gun laws after Columbine. There were a variety of measures that had been passed. They were going to be signed at the NRA convention 10 days after Columbine. Those were withdrawn really by the gun lobby and the sponsors, but most of them had become law within a couple of years. Now, there was a state law that preempted municipalities from doing anything more restrictive, so you couldn't pass something that wasn't already in place at the state level. An assault weapons ban in Denver went away. It had been found constitutional by the Colorado Supreme Court, and it's an example. Josh, I agree with you that it can happen with the stroke of a pen, and this debate gets into this series of false choices that you're either going to solve it or not by doing it or not doing it. And the question is it an appropriate public policy that might actually make it more difficult?
our mental health background check something that would be better off? When I was governor, I had a person shot and killed outside the governor's office who was definitely a mental health. He was suffering from a mental disease. He was denied the purchase of a firearm in Fort Collins, but he bought one either that day or a day later in Arvada, and there was no background test on mental health. And so should we have at least this discussion and not pretend we're going to prevent for all time another Aurora shooting, but is it an appropriate public policy choice to look at this intersection between mental health and firearms and say, can we do more or do it better?
Let me take a add to that a little bit. Jordan Marsh, who's the granddaughter of Sondra Marsh, who works in our development department, was in Theater 9 the day of the shooting, and I asked her for some thoughts about it, and I thought she had a great take. I mean, Josh, it's not so unlike what you see. She says, I believe that some people have guns in their homes for protection. I don't think that there should be any new laws passed that would take their feelings of safety in their own homes away. I do believe that there should be gun restrictions, meaning that there should be certain guns that absolutely no one should be able to get a hold of except for the people in the Army who are trained to use them. I believe that all strictly military weapons should be kept that way. Josh, are there lines? Are there places? We've seen Antonin Scalia, for example, talk about maybe there are lines. As you think about this, as we all think about this together, where are the lines, where, if any, at this point in terms of gun control?
Well, the state and federal statute books are full of lines, hundreds and probably thousands of gun laws that articulate lines, and it's important to recognize that probably hundreds and thousands of those laws were broken. And that's where the discussion about the efficacy of gun laws comes in. Will they work? The governor's point is a fair one, but if you look at Norway, some of the most restrictive gun laws in the free world, and yet the massacre happened there. Virginia Tech a few years back, a gun-free zone, and yet a massacre took place there. Even in the theater that night, there was actually an out-and-out prohibition on guns on the premises imposed at the corporate level. And so I think what the public expects of their leaders is a thoughtful discussion. And a piece of that thoughtful discussion is to recognize that there are limitations to how far these controls can go in actually preventing incidents like these.
It's very difficult to have a thoughtful discussion, I'd suggest, at this time, while so many families are angry and grieving. There is no good time to have this discussion. In some ways, and I think the governor was right to suggest, in some ways, that the challenge for policymakers is not to ask what would have prevented this particular tragedy, because the answer to that question, as agonizing and heartbreaking as it may be, the answer may be nothing. Nothing might have stopped this monster from doing what he did. But that doesn't forgive us of the responsibility to ask all sorts of tough questions as policymakers every day.
I think one of the things, again, is to try to provide a balance and a reflection on it, that somebody like Bill O'Reilly, again, Jordan was in the theater with Jarrell Sangster, who's her boyfriend, and he said that he was worried about the idea of the cost of the bullets, the clip size, the control of them. I think what was befuddling, and I saw Bill O'Reilly talk about this, is that how could someone of mental instability accumulate an arsenal of 6,000 pieces of ammunition in such a short period of time? And I'm trying to start, Bill, maybe you can talk a little bit about what should happen between the confluence of mental health and gun law.
And again, you can do more, and it may not prevent this, but it may at least make it more difficult. First of all, internet sales are a bit troubling, that you can do things and really do them almost anonymously. You know, people, federally licensed firearm dealers can actually turn down a person who comes in and presents with a mental health disease or defect, and yet you can't do that over the internet. There's no database that, you know, says these are the people who should be restricted in some fashion from internet purchases, and certainly not a database. And there's a very limited number of questions you can ask as a federally licensed firearm dealer about the mental health background of a person. Only whether or not you've been adjudicated, meaning a judge has found you to be diseased or defective, and not about whether you're under care, whether you have been hospitalized, whether, you know, you've had a recent diagnosis and none of those things. And so there should probably be some discussion about that and how you would do background checks differently. We fought this fight on concealed weapons and lost in Colorado. We fought it on firearm purchases and lost. So there's very, very little about that. And both on internet sales and in-person purchases, the just the very few things you can ask about mental health really don't get to whether or not we're selling firearms and ammunition to people who, just as a policy matter, we should agree should not have them.
What troubles me, I think, at times is just the percentages. I think Colorado has been victimized. If Mother Jones is correct, you've had 56 mass shootings in the last 30 years, and if population were right, you'd expect zero or one in Colorado, and we've had four. Is it something about the mental health system? About 80% of the time, Josh will ask you a little bit about it. Is it something about the mental health funding, the mental health system, the geographic culture? What do you think attributes to that higher number, or is it just random?
Well, it's hard to finger the mental health systems in this case, because according to various media reports, this person was actually seeing state-funded psychiatrist, and there's lots of details that will emerge obviously in the coming weeks and months in that respect. But this is the person who had access to those systems. What does it mean? I mean, all of these conversations, whether we like it or not, are coming up as an upshot or a consequence of this tragedy. And I think the public is rightly slow to cede freedoms because of a situation like this, when there's no fundamental proof that it would lessen the likelihood that would happen.
Just to add to this, I mean, there are all sorts of good reasons, it seems to me, to increase support for mental health funding, and a terrific number of advocates who have been making this case every day. The governor's wife, our former First Lady Jeanne Ritter, is one of those advocates. So it seems to me, well, we're having this conversation at this time for this reason, we ought not to shortchange the work that still needs to go on in the state.
And you don't need to cede a lot of freedoms to make it about mental health. You know, Josh, that middle school shooting that happened out in the Southwest metro area, I remember the person in that shooting, and nobody died, but you know, there are a variety of kids in this school that were traumatized and some that were injured, and the father said, I can't get him treatment. And if you remember that war, he said, I can't get him in treatment. Now, if you remember that case, we didn't pay much attention to that case when it went to trial. I think three separate psychiatrists said he was insane. There was a fourth that said he found him sane, went to trial. The jury found him insane. He's in a mental hospital now. It was a mass shooting. It was at a school, but because nobody died, we paid less attention to it as a consequence. But I can remember the father's plea for help as just, again, we shouldn't make it about any one case, but making me think, what did the system do that we actually couldn't get that guy into treatment, and instead he found his way to a middle school with, you know, weapons that he fired off?
Right. We've discussed this. I have a family member who had a brain injury, and we went through a series of episodes where the maximum the family could get was a series of 72-hour holds, and at the end of the day, this person, my sibling, was released to his own devices. That to me is an indicator that families who want to intervene in the lives of family members, there is a freedom issue. I think Josh or Andrew, that the right of somebody who has a mental illness to run their own life collides with the desire of the society, the family, to create an opportunity to help them. So have you seen that? How do you deal with that,
sure,
as legislators?
I think you're right. You got to comport the public policy interests that are at stake within the confines of the Constitution. I want to say this, though. The kind of conversation that we're having now is the right kind of policy conversation for citizens and their elected officials to make. What happens too often in politics, I think, instead, is an attempt by both sides to demonize the other, to denigrate their patriotism, to proclaim the opposition not just wrong, but un-American. You saw it on the left when folks caricatured General Petraeus as Betrayus, and you see it now from the right when folks question the legitimacy of the President of the United States. That makes it very difficult to have thoughtful policy conversations in this country.
And this conversation about guns and, you know, gun restrictions, gun control, whatever you want to call it, is one of the most polarizing. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, when you're running for office, you get a score from the NRA, and I mean a score like a grade, like an F in my case. And, you know, I mean, I'm a gun owner. I have hunted since I was in third grade. I still hunt as an adult. And it wasn't so much about what I thought about guns as how I had testified before with respect to specific measures. But it's less about a conversation where three people like us can sit down and say, okay, is there some new avenue we should think about here that would make it more difficult for these kinds of events to occur or that would help us protect public safety without ceding much freedom, but instead it becomes this matter of false choices, even in the legislature where it's about this or this. You're either for it or against it, and then you're going to be graded on it, and you're going to have to answer to that in the campaign mode. And the gun lobby in this state is pretty powerful. It is in this country.
But that's because it's not just. I think that's an over to blame the gun lobby is an oversimple analysis. The reality is that guns are and have been a part of our culture. And some people in some places, the elites in our society treat that as a bad thing. But it's reality. I mean, you look at like people like John Salazar, Sal Pace, who's running for Congress over in the 3rd Congressional District, representing a rural part of the state of Colorado. They are very slow to, they get A's from the NRA, like I did, because I think they appreciate and respect the fact that guns have a role in our society and in our culture and in entire state. The other thing that's important, and for example, when I hear Congressman Perlmutter or Diana DeGette, they were quick to get in front of the cameras and in ways that, for me personally, were pretty offensive. All the levers of power were in their hands for a number of years, and we never heard anything about that. And so I think that's why the public is sort of cynical about these new calls in the wake of this new tragedy. If these were so necessary, why then weren't they acted on then, and why are we sort of leveraging this controversy now for that?
I think that's a good place to go in terms of a public policy conversation. You say guns are and have been a part of the society, but cars are and have been a part of the society for a long time. Yet, we study cars. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars a year to understand how to make them more safe, that we've dropped the fatality rate in automobiles dramatically. But today in America, how much money are we spending to ask about how to make gun control and gun safety bigger when 32,000 fatalities a year in car accidents, 31,000 fatalities a year in gun-related violence? Should we have a conversation that lets us see differently the impact of gun laws? Or is it that the NRA is so passionate about what they do and it's a freedom issue? How do you start to parse that argument? Because we do study other things that have damage to us, but we don't, in my view, and what I could research for this today, we don't have a lot of study about how to diminish gun deaths.
I'd say, one, we ought to be respectful of the families who are grieving. Two, we ought to have tough conversations about complex public policy issues every day. What I heard Congressman Perlmutter say was no different from what he has said, frankly, in his time of office. I heard him say on this occasion that he was feeling, as we all are, grief-stricken and angry, and he recognized that emotions are raw. I don't know that his policy stance changed on account of the tragedy that unfolded in his district.
Yeah, and I think, you know, moderators of conversations will go right to the issue of gun control as a way to talk about this. I saw it happen, and on the left and the right, they'll ask questions, and it gets us into this place of what I call the false choice. So, Josh, I understand you can get different grades, and I probably got my grade because I was a big city DA. And because I was in arguing for what I thought were reasonable gun restrictions for the city and county of Denver, and not to have those go away because at the state level they wanted to do something other than give us local control. And they have their right to grade you out on that, but the fact of the matter is I feel like there's too little reasonable conversation here. Like, you don't have the ability to say, let's sit down and think about this in a whole new fashion, and not just because of the Aurora shooting or Columbine or the shooting that happened in Bailey at Platte Canyon High School or the shooting in the middle school or, you know, these things that we've experienced, but because as a country we're in this different place. There are 300 million guns on the streets of America or in homes in America. We still have the Second Amendment. We believe in it, but we need to have this other conversation because of the Internet. And because of Internet sales, because of the anonymity with which you can purchase guns and not ever appear in front of somebody where they might see really physically that you suffer from some kind of a mental disease or defect. And that's all I'm asking, is that we have a rational conversation where we don't get caught up in the polarizing effect of interest groups, and not just the NRA, but interest groups on both sides.
Yeah.
I think it's appropriate to pivot now. I was struck by the behavior of the people that you saw in the theater, whether it was Jordan or Jarrell, everybody I saw spoken to. Let's visit a little bit about what was positive about the incident. Your thought about the victims and the actions.
Well, you saw acts of tremendous heroism. It might not be much comfort to someone who lost a loved one in that incident to suggest that it could have been worse. But the truth is, a lot of folks, as they acknowledged, owe their lives to the courage of their neighbors and friends in that theater.
Yeah, I mean, bravery on a historic scale. I mean, like what young men showed on the beaches of Normandy. I mean, you literally had three young men who threw themselves, knowing the consequences, on top of another person and died because of it. Or the young girl, is that horrifying story that's trying to pull a body off of this young girl who ultimately died to give her CPR, I think 10 or 11 years ago. For all the bad in society, it speaks to the indomitable will of humanity. And there were some incredible stories that rose from the ashes of that tragedy.
The diversity of it all. You're from Aurora. You know that community. Give us a sense.
Yeah, our farm was about a mile from this, and then my mother moved into town and moved on the other side, less than a mile. Yes, I have a bunch of siblings who still live in Aurora. We know people who died or were injured, and. So it's interesting. I think when an event like this happens, the impact zone has a ripple effect, and that ripple effect is about trauma. And so immediately there's that trauma, and we as a community owe it to the victims of that to do whatever we can to address that. But it's statewide and it's national. And all the people in the high school at Columbine had to go back and open their folder from Columbine again and look at their folder. It's their brain folder that's about trauma. And we should think about it from the perspective of what we as a community do to ensure we support them in reacting to that trauma.
We owe this conversation, I think, the effort to do this. We waited a couple weeks here, and so I appreciate each of you participating. I want to thank Governor Ritter, Josh Penry, Andrew Romanoff, and end by this thought. Bill Clinton once said, "There's nothing wrong with America that can't be fixed by that which is right with America." As a Coloradan, I agree with you guys. I'm proud of the courage and heroism of a random group of people in a theater on a terrible night who were subjected to the unimaginable. Black, white, Latino, native-born or immigrant, this horrific act in many ways has been redeemed by the heroic actions and thoughtful words of those who've had to endure its consequences. Please join me in remembering these victims.